Welcome to the New England Journal of Medicine Outbreaks Update. I'm Stephen Morrissey, Executive Managing Editor of the Journal, and I'm talking with Eric Rubin, Editor-in-Chief, and Lindsay Baden, Deputy Editor. This week, we published an account of a current outbreak that's had a lot of media attention. And today, we welcome two guests. Steve Kornfeld is a physician who was a passenger aboard the cruise ship where the outbreak occurred. And Angela Hewitt is a professor at the University of Nebraska Medical Center and director of the Nebraska Biocontainment Unit, which has taken in some of that ship's passengers. Before we talk with them, Eric, can you tell us what we learned in the published article this week?
Thanks, Steve. So the outbreak occurred across the cruise ship MV Hondius, which was traveling in the South Atlantic. A man developed symptoms of pneumonia on April 21st. His illness rapidly progressed, and he was transferred to Johannesburg for further care. It soon became clear that this was all part of a cluster of cases, including a man who had died with respiratory failure 10 days earlier, and his partner, who became ill, flew to Johannesburg on her way to the Netherlands, but was too ill to travel further and ended up dying in an emergency room in South Africa. As of May 13th, there were a total of 10 cases aboard the ship, including three who ultimately succumbed to their illness. The lab in South Africa was able to isolate pathogen nucleic acid from patients and found that it was a hantavirus known as Andes virus. Andes virus has been found in Argentina, the port from which the cruise originated. The sequence of the viral RNA was very similar to that seen in previous isolates.
So what do we know about this virus?
Hantaviruses are rodent viruses that cause generally two different syndromes. The first, that's seen in Europe and Asia, is known as hemorrhagic fever with renal syndrome. It can vary quite a bit in severity, but at its worst, it causes widespread bleeding and often renal dysfunction. The New World hantaviruses cause what's called hantavirus pulmonary syndrome. This is a severe pneumonia that's often rapidly progressive. It was first described in the American Southwest, but can result from a number of different hantaviruses spread through the Americas. The striking thing about this outbreak, though, is a large number of apparent person-to-person transmission events. Most hantaviruses are transmitted through exposure to their rodent hosts. Andes virus is unusual in that we published a report back in 2020 of human-to-human spread that occurred in Argentina. That outbreak resulted in a large number of infections and several deaths. Thus, while unusual, we know that this can happen.
So let's turn to our guest. Steve, you had an unfortunate front row seat at this outbreak. What can you tell us about life aboard the ship?
Well, a bunch of us got on the ship for a five-week cruise, a long cruise, visiting remote islands, seeing unusual birds and unusual mammals. It was very festive. I knew a lot of the people on the boat. I met a lot of new people on the boat who were there for other reasons besides bird watching. People to see penguins, people to get new territories on their territory list. It was just festive and a lot of fun.
And I understand that since the ship's doctor became ill, you took on some medical duties. What's it like to practice medicine on a cruise ship?
Well, that happened towards the end of the cruise, the last third or quarter of the cruise. Most of the cruise, as people were dying or getting sick, we were trying not to connect the dots. It just seemed too unlikely that everything was connected. It was only at the end of April when a number of people got sick, and then early May when we heard the word hantavirus that we began to connect it. For me, I just kind of innocently asked if I could be of assistance when I heard a passenger was getting sick. I was told that the doctor was also sick. Maybe I could help out. And then within 12 hours, I was suddenly in charge of the sick people and the physician or medical representative to all the passengers on the boat. It was a very rapid transition.
So, Steve, on the ship, as folks are getting sick, how do you think about where you care for them? What kind of facilities were available to take care of other passengers getting sick?
Well, the boat has, or the ship has, a two-bed, what they call hospital, but it's really an infirmary that just has two beds and oxygen. And so we decided, myself along with some of the other staff, just to care for people in their room. It felt a little bit safer. We can move oxygen tanks into their room. So the facilities are really quite basic and quite limited.
Steve, did you have PPE on board to protect yourself and the other passengers?
Well, I started caring for the other passengers and the staff on May 1st. We didn't really hear hantavirus until May 2nd. But we had a sense that something was wrong. I mean, a lot of people were getting sick. We were also listening to the reports from Johannesburg about the patient who had been evacuated. And he'd been there for 5 days. And every day we heard, we do not have a diagnosis. So we were thinking, if this is an infection, by now they should have come up with something, some pathogen. But we still felt something was wrong. So from the beginning, I wore a mask and gloves. Turned out the ship had a huge COVID repository in a back closet filled with N95 aprons and goggles. So once I found that, I was able to kind of get a little bit more elaborate with my PPE.
Well, that sounds like serendipity that there was PPE tucked away on the ship that you were able to access and sounds potentially life-saving. Any diagnostics on the ship? Are you able to diagnose anything, or it really is symptom management? And then if you're suspicious of an infection, to try and restrict interaction?
It's more the latter. They had two finger stick tests, troponin and D-dimer. Not all that practical in our circumstances. And all the rest was just supportive maneuvers like steroids, antipyretics, fluids, and oxygen.
Let me turn to Angela. Your facility has taken in several passengers from the ship. What can you tell us about the Nebraska Biocontainment Unit?
Well, here at the University of Nebraska Medical Center, we actually have two facilities that are designed for individuals with suspected or confirmed or those exposed to high consequence infectious diseases. We have the Nebraska Biocontainment Unit, which is our inpatient space. It serves as the Regional Emerging Special Pathogen Treatment Center for Region 7. And the facility itself is very distinct from a typical patient care space, although in the room itself, it does look like a typical hospital room. But the difference with the Nebraska Biocontainment Unit compared to a regular hospital space is really part of the environment and the fact that the facility has its own air handling system. So it's like a separate box from the rest of the healthcare center. It also has HEPA filtration of exhausted air. It's negative pressure throughout on a gradient. We have an in-house laboratory as well as autoclaves that are designed to dispose of a waste. But really the most important part of the Nebraska Biocontainment Unit are our trained team of healthcare workers. These are all volunteer physicians, nurses, and others, as well as our well-practiced protocols and procedures, which we spend a lot of time dealing with in times of peace. The NBU has now been activated three separate times. So first for Ebola virus disease in 2014, where we cared for three patients that had confirmed Ebola. And then again, for some of the first COVID patients in the United States that were medically evacuated from the Diamond Princess cruise ship in very early 2020. And then last week for a suspected case of Andes hantavirus, which you'll hear about in a minute. Our second facility is the National Quarantine, which is also located on our campus. It is a federally funded facility and really the only facility of its kind in the United States. There are 20 rooms in the quarantine, and these are not patient care spaces. They're not designed that way. They're instead really designed to create a safe space for individuals who need to be monitored because they've been exposed to infectious diseases. This is not, again, a patient care space with the typical medical gases and other things that you would have in a hospital. The quarantine unit first activated in 2020, in very early 2020, due to the Diamond Princess cruise ship's individuals, and now is activated for Andes hantavirus.
How was the decision made to take on these people for treatment and for quarantine?
So we're one of 13 regional emerging special pathogen treatment centers in the United States, but we're the only unit that has the quarantine unit on campus. So that distinguishes us from the other biocontainment units. It was designed this way in order to provide quarantine service, but really to have that ready access to the full complement of clinical care for individuals who, should they develop clinical illness and need to be transferred to the biocontainment units. We, along with the other regional emerging special pathogen treatment centers in the U.S., are in a constant state of readiness to care for individuals either exposed to or infected with high consequence pathogen, but The decision to utilize a national quarantine unit is that really lies with our federal partners from the Administration for Strategic Preparedness and Response, or ASPR. So activation of the national quarantine unit typically begins with a call from ASPR, followed by a discussion with our internal leadership team, along with hospital leaders and the state and local public health authorities.
Anvil, if I'm hearing you correctly, it sounds like the two really important concepts you're bringing forward. One is biocontainment, which someone is sick, ill with the high consequence pathogen, you're able to care for them, do invasive and other procedures to care for them. And that's biocontainment. And then you have quarantine, where you're observing to see if, let's say, they're incubating. And that's more an observing rather than biomedical intervention.
Yes, absolutely. And those two get confused a lot, the terms quarantine versus isolation. And that's something that I know we saw a lot during COVID-19, where people confuse those terms and what they mean. But the biocontainment unit is designed for isolation, whereas the quarantine is designed for quarantine and monitoring and observation.
And in that quarantine unit, you're keeping those you quarantine separate, so they're unlikely to transmit to each other.
Yes, I mean, that's the intent, is to provide that safe space for individuals who have potentially been exposed to high consequence pathogens to carry out their quarantine period. But again, it's not a medical care facility. We are able to do some outpatient type medical services, particularly for people with medication refills or routine medical care, but it's definitely not designed as an inpatient facility. It's designed more for people to complete their quarantine period in more of a hotel type environment.
Because what it sounds to me like, Steve, what you were doing on the ship was you essentially were, by default and urgency of circumstance, created quarantine. You had individuals stay in their rooms. You brought, I assume, food and care to the room rather than commingling. And so the concept of quarantine you operationalized, which probably made a difference in the transmission. Am I hearing you correctly?
Yes, it was sort of a transition. When we heard the first ANTA turn on May 2nd, people started thinking, something's going on here. People were beginning to wear masks. On May 4th, when we heard the second ANTA diagnosis in a patient, then we knew, even before we were told that this was Andy's ANTA, and it was spreading throughout the ship. And then we went into more of a lockdown, with people isolated in their rooms, but still going outside in the wind, and people still ate in the dining room, but kept separate. So it wasn't isolation per se, because nobody was ill, and it wasn't a full quarantine, but it was heading that way.
In a way, this is a bit of a throwback, because the term quarantine comes from the idea of isolating on a ship for 40 days in harbor. I would imagine, though, that isolating in Nebraska is a little more comfortable.
Well,
it's okay, Steve, you can answer it.
The ship has really good food.
We've done our best with that, but it is definitely not cruise-worthy cuisine. We've tried to make things more comfortable, but in essence, I mean, it's a quarantine period. A facility that's not a nice cruise or a home environment, but we've had some food trucks and pizza delivery and all things like that to try to make things a little more comfortable, but we're doing the best we can.
Yeah. It's a unit that, at least an outsider's perspective, is designed for fantastic virus control. And it's a unit designed for hospital staff to be able to come in and do their jobs. It's maybe slightly less of a unit designed for guest comfort.
So the bird watching is not as good.
Well, I happen to have a couple of windows.
We're working on that.
A little bird shit.
We're working on that. We're also doing some programming and things as best we can to try to engage folks. And some of those are with some of our kind of local wildlife specialists or other things, but it still lived. Quarantine. It's not the same as being outdoors and seeing the birds.
While in quarantine, Angela, I'm sure you're monitoring for evidence of illness infection. What is that monitoring, and what kind of testing are you routinely doing in those in quarantine to determine if infection has occurred?
Well, the individuals that are with us now have undergone different types of testing, both here in-house, which mostly has consisted of PCR testing, as well as with the CDC, which has consisted of serologic testing. Those were done and are being done on a cadence that we feel is most appropriate and really individualized for each person, thinking about their preferences as well as their exposure history and potential for development of illness. So we are testing these individuals and monitoring them. They do get twice daily temperature checks. That is something that's been recommended by our public health partners. And so we do twice daily temperature checks to make sure that no one is developing a fever. And we also do symptom checks at that time as well. The individuals that are with us have a phone number to call should they develop any symptoms in the meantime, in between those temperature checks. But we are monitoring. Now, we don't have eyes on individuals all the time, so there's no cameras in the rooms or anything like that because it's not designed that way. It's really more designed for periodic monitoring as opposed to, say, our biocontainment, which, as Steve knows well now, is much more of an eyes on situation since we're providing that potentially critical care interventions there.
I understand that you did have a false positive. What happened and how do you follow up on that?
I did get some nasal swabs done on the ship in early May, and they eventually made their way to the Netherlands and they were tested. And I came back as a weakly positive on one test and a negative on another test. They were done in two different labs. So because I wasn't negative, I was listed as positive. And that sort of hit the news as an American test positive for hantavirus. As a result, I was transported back to the States, isolated from the others. I was in the box on the 747 cargo plane that transferred all of us. And then I went directly to the biocontainment unit. So I've had the good fortune to experience both the biocontainment unit as an inpatient and now the quarantine unit as an outpatient. It was kind of surreal being in the biocontainment unit because I got there at 2 in the morning. I was exhausted. I was wrapped up in a lot of protective gear. I could barely see forward. But I just ended up in this room that looks like a regular hospital room. Quickly, you realize what's going on behind the scenes, all the different levels of virus containment and the very strict protocol that all the staff were participating in. At the same time, I'm asymptomatic. My first time as an inpatient, and I'm asymptomatic. After a couple of days, my PCR test came back negative, so that I moved over here to the quarantine unit with the others.
But Steve, what you raise is that PCR is a much quicker test. Serology, we know, both takes a while for the immune system to respond, and the turnaround is often not as quick. We're left, you know, some of us, I'm wondering how many others are on the ship may have been asymptomatically infected. And are we having, and Angela, you may know this, a sero program to see how many of those on the ship were turned seropositive, whether or not they developed symptoms?
Currently here in the United States, and this is being done in different ways in different parts of the world, but the CDC does not recommend serologic testing unless an individual had some symptoms of some sort to suggest that they possibly had the clinical illness. That being said, the majority of our passengers actually did have some symptoms during their cruise, which I think Steve describes as the cruise flu that went around kind of midway through the cruise. And so our individuals were tested with serologic assays because of that scenario. And Steve can give more details of that, but there was some thought that maybe some of these individuals had developed a subclinical or mild illness with hantavirus at some point during the cruise.
Yeah, my ship flu actually happened quite early in the cruise, and the timing never felt right to me that it would be hanta. It was just too soon. You know, at one point there was a thought that multiple people got hanta before the cruise and brought it onto the cruise. That never really made sense based on the locations we were at, the fact that number of the infected people on the boat were never at these locations, and the timing. But there was still a thought that maybe I had had hanta, but my serology was negative, so I had not had hanta. And since I'm not acting here as anybody's physician, I know the results of everybody else in the quarantine unit, and nobody showed any evidence of any recent infections. One gentleman had serology that suggested a remote infection, probably with a non-Andes type. So at least among our 17 people, there's no evidence that any of us had had a subclinical or mildly clinical infection.
And I think these data are really important because I'm not sure we know the full spectrum of illness for these new pathogens that we experience. And often we'll see the severe illness, as Steve, you witnessed, but we do need to understand the spectrum of illness to better understand the transmission patterns and the implications. So thank you for sharing those thoughts and data.
Yeah, so can I just say, this is a very unique opportunity that we have here because we have this cohort of individuals with potential exposures. Most of the data that we have thus far has really been individuals who become very ill and present for medical care. And so the opportunity to actually look at the potentially early clinical presentation, diagnostics, there are just so many opportunities here with this cohort, as well as those around the world, to really learn about Andes hantavirus and some of the, you know, the very early diagnostic and clinical manifestations we can see with this.
Angela, hantavirus isn't the only dangerous disease that we're looking at now. Given the Ebola outbreak that's occurring in the Democratic Republic of Congo and Uganda, is it possible that you're going to need to take on more patients? And if that moment comes, how do you decide?
Well, the decision to medically evacuate individuals from overseas for care in the biocontainment units or for monitoring in the quarantine is really made at the federal level. You know, we are always monitoring what's going on in the world of high consequence pathogens from a global standpoint. And the Ebola outbreak that is occurring in the Democratic Republic of the Congo and surrounding countries is very concerning to me and is moving at a rapid rate. Then there's a possibility that one or more of the biocontainment units here in the United States will be asked to care for infected individuals or potentially monitor exposed individuals. However, these decisions will be made by our federal partners and will totally depend on the feasibility of transfer, the location, and also the status of the patient. When someone presents domestically, it's an entirely different conversation because that means a person is presenting to our emergency departments or clinics or elsewhere. And the National Emerging Special Pathogens Training and Education Center, or NETEC, assists with response coordination within our network of care facilities at that point.
And Anvil, I think I've heard you say earlier that there are 13 units across the country. What is our capacity? How many beds do we have across the 13 units?
So that's a great question. And really, it's dependent on the pathogen, number one, because some pathogens, like for instance, Ebola virus disease is a category A agent, which means that the waste needs to be autoclaved or disposed of appropriately. Whereas other agents, say MERS-CoV is a good example of that, doesn't have that same waste stream and need for, you know, for that specialized disposal of waste. And so the waste is actually a big limitation for this type of care. And so most of the units have a 2 to 3 bed capacity for patients with viral hemorrhagic fever, or those patients that potentially are critically ill. And so that also plays into it, is the status of the patient, how sick they are, and how many beds are available and how many patients we can care for. But for a respiratory disease, we typically can take up to 10 patients, depending on, again, the clinical status of the patient. So really, we have 13 regional special pathogen centers, but actually, we also have some level 2 facilities, what we call level 2 facilities around the United States, that are not the regional special pathogen treatment centers, but they do have capability as well. So we, you know, we have beds at each of those facilities, but it's highly dependent on what pathogen we're dealing with and the status of the patient. And so we really lean very heavily on our federal partners as well as the NETEC network to determine which units are currently active, how many patients we can take, and where those individuals will go.
So, Angela, it sounds like ballpark, we're talking a couple of dozen beds for the most extreme case. And for circumstances that are less complicated, it may be 100. You ballpark.
For the RESPECs, or the regional special pathogen treatment centers. Yes, that's true.
And As I understand it, then, when there are triage decisions to be made, those decisions would be made centrally, not by the individual facilities.
Well, we report out every week, or sometimes more than once weekly, like now, basically looking at our, you know, our preparedness and kind of reporting out, because there are also things that occur at these units, even construction projects or repairs that are needed, or team dynamic issues where, you know, maybe the unit may be offline for a pediatric patient or something like that, that we are constantly reporting and assessing. And so that is a bit of a moving target, but that's the reason that the network was created, so that we wouldn't just have a couple of facilities that are able to do this type of care. And so we can lean on each other across the United States. And these facilities are designated according to Health and Human Services regions. So for instance, our facility is the facility in Region 7. We have, you know, facilities that are spread out around the United States to give some geographic distribution also to this type of care.
Do we have enough capacity?
You know, I've been doing this for a long time. I always feel like we need more capacity because we don't know what's in the future. And I think just given the scenario right now with converging outbreaks of Andes hantavirus as well as Ebola virus disease, particularly the outbreak of Ebola virus disease that's occurring in Central Africa is very concerning. And I do worry about having the appropriate capacity. I think that we can always build capacity and capabilities here in the United States. And you know, what we need to continue to do that is sustained funding in order to support these facilities, because we have to continue to maintain these facilities as well as our trained teams. And that's not an easy concept, especially in times of peace when we don't necessarily have an ongoing outbreak. And also, you know, there's very much it's very easy for people to kind of forget this scenario when we haven't experienced an outbreak in a few years. And so that's something that is, you know, our funding is can go away based on, you know, kind of short-term memory. And I think that part is something that we should continue to remember and to continue to build these facilities and sustain them.
So an analogy, and tell me if this analogy fits. Are these containment units like the fire department? We need to support them, maintain them, but when there isn't a fire, we don't need them. So why are we maintaining them? When there is a fire, boy, do we need the resources to be available.
That's actually an excellent analogy. And that when you need us, we want to be here. And we want to make sure that we have those trained teams of healthcare workers and the appropriate facilities to care for individuals with high consequence pathogens. And the only way to really do that is to continue to maintain and support these types of endeavors in these units.
Thank you, Angela and Steve, for joining us today. And as always, thank you, Eric. Thank you, Lindsay.